And now, Move the Sticks with Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks.
Oh, here we go. Back here with you on Move the Sticks. Welcome back, everybody. Rhett Lewis and Bucky Brooks here with you. And look, coming off of Monday where we were looking ahead to what was one of the most anticipated Monday Night Football games of the season, Bucky, it ends up being one of the most intriguing Monday Night Football games of the season, one of the more interesting game plans we've ever seen as a result of the conditions that were going on there at Highmark Stadium in Orchard Park, New York. Look, I'm going to give you this stat and then I'll let you run with it. The Patriots adjusted to inclement weather, this according to Next Gen Stats, and ran the ball on 94% of their plays, the highest run rate in a game in this millennium. What's up, dude? How we doing?
Look, I'm doing great, Rhett, because to me, I loved it. I absolutely love watching it go down. I thought it was a very impressive game plan. I credit Josh McDaniels for being able to kind of put his ego in check to kind of stick to the script. They ran the football. They ran it successfully. Now, I don't know how much different the game plan would have been if it was regular conditions. I feel like the Patriots were going to run it. I mean, obviously, I think they probably would have thrown it more than three times. But, I mean, I think the biggest strength of the Patriots attacks the biggest weakness of the Bills, which is running the football. And I think what happened last night, I think in the middle of the game, I think the football world did the collective, oh, no, the Patriots.
Here we go.
Oh, no. Yeah, because, like, we've talked about this. Like, to me, this was very reminiscent of, like, how they used to play in the early 2000s. Like, it's not a lot of sizzle and pizzazz to how they would get down. But this is a team that prides themselves on not beating themselves. They don't typically turn the ball over. And they wait for you to crack. And teams have shown for two decades that they cracked under having to execute under pressure. And so, to me, this is what they did. And I think Mac Jones' comments were telling. He said, if we didn't turn the ball over, we knew that we could win. So that wasn't a thing that was just said on Monday before they ran out on the field. That is something that they had talked about throughout the week. We will beat this team if we don't turn it over. And so, to me, this was just kind of like all of that coming to fruition, even though it was an alternative game plan.
So we're going to get into the college football playoff matchups. We're going to get into to those games, the semifinal matchups, and what might happen when we get to a national title game. We're going to talk about Mario Cristobal getting hired by Miami away from Oregon as that program now looks for its next head coach. Get to all that. But back here on this Patriots-Bills game, like, you know, it's one thing to game plan. Like, all right, we're going to run the you-know-what out of the ball against this team. It's another thing to be able to execute that. Now, I mean, Bucky, how many times in how many games over the course of your football-watching career have you seen teams absolutely inept at running the football? The Bills knew. If they didn't know at the start of the game, they knew midway through the first quarter, into the second quarter, like, all right, they're coming right at us here. We got to figure out a way to stop it. And for the most part, they couldn't.
Not Red, they really couldn't stop him until the very end of the game when they kind of sold out and blitzed through the A gaps a few times and kind of did some of those other things. But to me, what it was the Patriots doing what I think the Patriots kind of do is they kind of boldly let you know exactly what they're about. You know, like, I don't think they sugarcoat anything. Like, they just kind of line up and say, like, man, this is what we do. It's not a lot of trickery to how they play and how they get down and how they perform. And so I just thought that the Patriots lined up in 21 personnel, two backs, one tight end, two wide receivers. And they just said, we're going to make this a contest of toughness, physicality, and will. And we believe that our discipline, persistence running the football will eventually wear the Buffalo Bills down. Now, the backdrop of this coming into the game, the two most physical teams that have played the Buffalo Bills and had success running the ball. The Tennessee Titans, Derrick Henry ran for 140 yards. And then a few weeks ago, the Indianapolis Colts ran for over 200 yards with Jonathan Taylor playing a huge role and running the ball. And so, look, the way this league is, it's a copycat league. Until you show people that you've solved your biggest issue, you can get a steady diet of it over and over and over again. And that's what they did.
Yeah. And despite those games, I mean, this Bills defense, I mean, it's not like they were the 32nd rush defense in football. I mean, like they were still, you know, a top 10 rush defense, sixth best in the league in terms of limiting opponents' rushing yards. But again, look, the two outliers there, as you mentioned, that Indianapolis and that Tennessee game, which were, again, simply dominated. But I keep going back to it. Like, do you remember ever, Bucky, being a part of a game where it's like you go through that, you see it, you see it, you see it, and you just can't stop it?
So, Red, funny story. So I had to pull it up so I could give you the exact date. When I was a member of the Carolina Panthers, people will not remember this game, but hopefully you can find it on YouTube. It's Christmas Eve 2006. I'm with the Carolina Panthers, and starting quarterback Jake Delhomme is not playing. So Chris Winkie was the backup quarterback. And to tell you the lack of confidence that John Fox and the staff had in Chris Winkie, we ran the Wildcat the entire game with D'Angelo Williams and Deshaun Foster. The two guys, I'm looking at the stats now, D'Angelo ran the ball 28 times. No, D'Angelo ran it 21 times for 82 yards. Deshaun Foster ran it 28 times for 102 yards. The biggest game between the two of them was 11 yards. So when you think about a steady diet of just 3 and 4 and 3 and 4, and it was a game in which the Carolina Panthers won 10-3. So last night when I'm looking at the game, I was like, I've kind of seen this before. And we think about, like, teams can't do it because, you know, we just never see it. But there have been times. Chris Winkie threw the ball 7 times in that game. He was 4 for 7 for maybe 21 yards. But that's what it is. It's about running the football and being able to control it. And I think it is not a coincidence that John Fox was a defensive-minded coach. Bill Belichick comes from a defensive background, obviously. And they just kind of understand how difficult it is when someone just commits to running the ball and saying, oh, we're not going to throw it. We're going to run it and run it and run it and run it. And we'll see if you can stop it.
You know, I think there's maybe one guy on the Patriots team that had probably been involved in a game like that. It was probably Shaq Mason, who played at Georgia Tech, right? When they were running all that Paul Johnson stuff,
Triple
right?
Action, Paul Johnson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's probably like, oh, I'm into this. This is back to my roots here. You know, and look, the offensive line is one thing. Patriots have been able to find quality runners in their history, certainly. Ramondre Stevenson is another one. As a rookie this year, big dude, right? 6 foot, 227 pounds, coming out of Oklahoma, and ends up being the 4th round pick of the Patriots, but it has been one of the more productive rookie runners, you know, we've seen this year. Did you see this kind of production from him, like looking at him in college and projecting him to the league?
No, man, I think a lot of it, like I think a couple of different players with the Patriots that you didn't necessarily see. You could think that Mac Jones would be a solid starting quarterback. You didn't know that he would be this good or this effective until you understand where he goes. And I think that's the tough part about what we do when we talk about paths to the draft or whatever. It's one thing to analyze and evaluate players kind of independently. It's another thing to then look at them when you see where they are and how they're going to fit as a piece of the puzzle. I think for Ramondre Stevenson, he's big. He's physical. He could come downhill. He can catch the ball out the backfield and those things. But, man, did you think that he was going to be in a program where they asked him to come downhill between the tackles over and over and over again and kind of, I guess, thrive in that sledgehammer role? No, but now that you see it, you're like, oh, yeah, that worked. And so, Rhett, when we get to 2022 and we begin to talk about the draft, we will talk about no two draft boards look alike. Because teams have different visions for how they see players fitting into their system and how they would utilize them. And so that is why the Patriots might be higher on Ramondre Stevenson than the Jets because of the picture in their mind that they have for the role that he would play. And look, I will say this. We've kind of taken the Patriots to task a long time for like what they've done drafting because they hadn't got a lot of return on investment in recent years. It looks like this offseason, they kind of figured out whatever was ailing them when it came to evaluation, and they're plugging and playing. And I think maybe this has to do with Matt Patricia kind of being back in the building. Maybe it has to be with some of the other guys that have kind of slowly crept back into the fold. And maybe this allowed Bill Belichick to not have to wear so many hats and kind of focus on what he does really, really well.
Which, as Aqib Talib told us on the Manning cast last night, make no mistake, he is the defensive coordinator. Just, you know, not like we all didn't think that anyway, but you see his son, Steve Belichick, calling plays, Gerard Mayo's call play. But Bill is the czar of the defense.
Yes.
Whatever title you want to give it to him, whichever way you want to describe it, he runs that show, as Aqib mentioned to Peyton and Eli last night, which was a pretty fun interview. Also said, you know, like, there are three things that you got to do, and you'll have a great time in New England. Number one, show up on time. Number two, know your stuff. And number three, don't mess around with the media. And he's like, other than that, Bill will leave you alone, man. You can wear onesie pajamas to walk through if you want. And so I thought that was pretty good from, you know, a guy like Aqib, you know, who certainly is a character and has personality and has fun. But, you know, showing that, you know, you do those things well and you'll have a good time playing in New England. We've all kind of talked about
it. Like to that point, though, like, because I do believe there's this perception that it's all drudgery in that building. But there have been too many characters who have played there successfully for it to be just all of that. I mean, look, Corey Dillon played there. Randy Moss played there.
Yes.
I mean, you know, Aqib Talib. Like, there have been a handful of guys who were kind of edgy when it came to, like, maybe character stuff. And all of them have played there, and none of them have had incidents. And so, to me, what Aqib Talib did is he kind of let us in on a little bit of the secret sauce.
Yeah.
Like, man, look, the man is only asking you, show up on time, know exactly what you're supposed to do. You know what I'm saying? Don't share the secret to the world. And then go play. I think the tough thing, and we know this, like, in just dealing in business, it's hard for people sometimes to take clear, direct directives. And I think what the Patriots do, I think it's very clear and apparent. When you walk in the building, here's what we expect of you, whatever.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who struggle with being told exactly what they expect and having to follow through on that, being held accountable to it.
It certainly works for New England. It works for this Patriots team sitting at the top of the AFC. Like, are they, in fact, like, a real force to be reckoned with here?
Yeah.
Are they essentially the team to beat in the AFC?
I would say, like, keep the Kansas City Chiefs in mind, because the way the Kansas City Chiefs are playing defensively, that gives them a chance, because at any point that offense can kind of find their way. Right. But, the Patriots have been the model of consistency. Right. And so when you're trying to figure out which teams you're going to project to be there in the end, you look for the teams that are consistent. And when you look at them, I think they probably have the fewest holes of the title contenders. Like, what can we really point to and say, like, hey, this is their biggest weakness? I think the biggest thing in the playoffs when we get to it will be, how does the rookie quarterback perform if the game is on his shoulders? But they have been so good at not having to put it on his shoulders that who's to say that someone's going to make them play in a game where Mac Jones has to throw it 50 times a game and he has to win it on the strength of his right arm?
Well, sure.
I mean, that's about the only thing we can say.
The Titans were a win away from the Super Bowl a couple of years ago with Tannehill throwing 8 passes a game in the playoffs. You know what I mean? Like, it's not exclusive to Mac Jones. So, look, I think you're right. I think this Patriots are back. They're the kings of the AFC East right now, and I feel like they absolutely were overjoyed to plant their flag back in the division on the road
in
Orchard
question.
Park, New York.
Okay, so let me just give you a little bit of perspective. So in Buffalo, when I got in Buffalo in 94, it was right at the end of the 4 Super Bowl run.
Yes.
And during that time, what the Bills would do is, like, it's silly when you think about it, but the Bills would always hang the AFC East banner whenever they would win the division. So you would see, like, year after year after year after year. And in Buffalo, for the longest time, the Bills owned the division.
Yes.
I mean, it was like a decade run of owning the division. And so that always was the thing. And it wasn't until the Patriots and Bill Parcells came in there that it kind of became a deal to do it. And so the reason why it's such a big deal now for the Patriots to take that back is because those who first stepped in knew what it was like. The Bills dominated that division. There's been no one else that has dominated the division like that. And so that's why it's such a big deal. They didn't say anything, but to me, the overjoyed feeling that you saw from the Patriots sideline, it was Bill Belichick kind of walking.
How about Bill? Like,
oh, yeah. Let me get
Bill
that
was
back.
Celebrating that, you know, give me that chain. It did feel like that. I mean, like he, you know, Bill celebrates from time to time, but like at the end of that game, you know, seeing that, that fourth down pass go incomplete and then seeing that, you know, the clock go to zero after Mac kneeled, you know, that was an overjoyed Bill going into a bye week as the number one seed in the AFC.
Quickly, because we hadn't really talked on the Buffalo Bills. Like, I think it's important to say this. Look, there was a little testy conversation that Jordan Poirier and Micah Hyde had
with
a reporter that asked him about whether it's embarrassing or not for the Patriots to run over them. I would say this. I don't think the Bills defense played bad. I think the one thing that the Bills are going to have to continue to figure out is, one, how do they play defense without Tre'Davious White? Because it does kind of change the way that they play. Did you continue to play as much man-to-man as you were playing with Tre'Davious White? Or do you go more to a zone-based system and just kind of do it? Like, they have a very high IQ secondary, so they can do a bunch of different things. I think their defense, obviously, those are the two best defenses in football. One leads the league in yards allowed. The other leads the league in points, which are the Patriots. The big thing for me with the Bills, their inability to kind of change styles. I feel like they only can win one way on offense, and that is Josh Allen playing big, running around, making all the plays. At some point, for them to make a legitimate run, they have to be able to run the football when everybody knows they need to run it. And it can't be number 17 always running it. So they have to develop a running game. And I think Sean McDermott talked on it, but he said at this stage of the season, I don't know if we can do it. And I was like, wait a minute now. Like, we have to figure out that to me is the biggest thing. I'm not necessarily worried about their defense. I am worried about Josh Allen having to do everything without a hint of a running game coming from another running back or another playmaker on the perimeter.
Devin Singletary, Zach Moss, Matt Breida. It's hard to figure out who they want to run the rock. Probably because none of the three have stepped up and had consistent success with it. And it's not all on them. It's on the guys up front too. It's on the commitment to it. It's on the scheme. It's on the whole deal. That part of the Bills game, I felt like last year, like going into the offseason, when we're talking about the Bills as a contender and you look at them as a potential, the potential weakness, like, well, outside of Josh Allen, like, they don't have a consistent run game. And that we're seeing here, no different through 13 weeks of the season.
It matters during this time of year. When you get to the stretch run, like, we can see all the fun stuff, the balls flying throughout the air. But at the end, when you're playing really good teams, the only way to control the game is you have to be able to run it. You have to be able to kind of control it and dictate the terms and not necessarily make it where, hey, Josh, you're going to have to throw it all the time. And also, you have to be able to run it, to run out the clock at the end of games and close games. And so how they manufacture run, and maybe that's being a little more creative. Maybe that's stealing some of the jet sweep, fly sweep concepts that are coming throughout the league. But they have to be able to get to 125 rushing yards a game without it all being Josh Allen.
Yeah. Maybe it's the answer is in this year's draft when Hassan Haskins is available after playing in the college football playoff, which we get into right after this here on Move the Sticks. All right, Red Lewis back here with Bucky Brooks looking at the college football playoff history made courtesy of the Cincinnati Bearcats. And as they will come into the playoff as the number 4 seed, they get a date with Alabama in the semis after Alabama dominated Georgia in the SEC championship game, dropping the Bulldogs to number 3. Georgia gets set for a matchup with Michigan, which we'll get into here in a second. But I want to start with Cincinnati because I think there's still doubters out there whether this team deserves to be in the college football playoff as an undefeated champion of the American Athletic Conference. They beat Houston fairly handily, which is another ranked team in the CFP top 25. There are as many dudes from this Cincinnati roster that we're going to be talking about in the spring leading up to the draft as almost any other school, maybe outside of Alabama and Georgia. Like, they have some serious NFL type talent. There's 6 of their best players going to the Senior Bowl this year. 6 players from Cincinnati. There's a 7th in Juice, the corner, who's going to be a first round pick. And you know, depending on how he graduates, he'll get into the offseason bowl, all-star game circuit too. But they are talented enough to hold up in this playoff, in my mind, Buck.
Yeah. So here's the issue that I think people have with Cincinnati. One, it's not the brand name that the other three teams are in terms of just understanding like who they are. When you think about college football, the names that routinely come to mind are Alabama, Georgia, Michigan, based on the long decorated histories of those respective programs. I think Cincinnati also last year when they had opportunity to play Georgia in the game, I think people tuned in and were surprised to see them go toe-to-toe. But I think a lot of people were dismissive because they're like, Georgia's not even into it. They're playing around. And then Georgia wins the game at the end. It's unfortunate for Cincinnati, though, that they're going to go against Alabama right out the gate, because it's almost kind of like, I kind of feel like the committee was like, okay, you want to play with the big boys? We can give you the biggest boy to play with right out the gate. We're just going to give you like the monster that has dominated the landscape over the last 10 years. That said, this is a really good team, and they are well coached, and they have a quarterback in Desmond Ridder, who we're going to talk about a ton.
Yes.
And they understand how to get it done. Luke Fickell has a team of, look, man, they're hungry. They're not afraid. And I know people are going to look at some of the close games they played with, talking about them playing up and down to the competition. But make no mistake, when they played Notre Dame, they whooped Notre Dame. Beat Notre Dame up.
Yes.
They beat them up. And so I think we need to give them enough respect to know that, hey, in this situation, when it's a one-and-done contest, they absolutely could rise up.
Forgive me. Apologies to Ahmad Sauce Gardner. Had my nicknames screwed up there. Call them Juice. Sauce Gardner. Sauce Gardner is going to be one of the best cornerbacks in this year's draft class when all that comes to bear. But he and, guys like Darian Beavers, linebacker, Myjai Sanders in an edge rush capacity, a couple of DBs. I mean, Kobe Bryant is the Thorpe Award finalist as a safety. Brian Cook, Alec Pierce is a wideout, is an explosive dude too. And then Desmond Ridder, as you mentioned, will be one of those top quarterbacks we talk about in that kind of first five off the board type of range. I don't know if we get five first round quarterbacks this year, but among those top five, he is certainly in that conversation. So, but look, Alabama knocked off the real big dogs, the Bulldogs, mm-hmm. and the team that was the wire to wire number one in the CFP rankings and in the polls this year based on their defense, and put up 40 on them. That's why, Bucky, I thought Ohio State versus Georgia, Ohio State would give Georgia the toughest test because of their aerial attack and not have to run it up against Jordan Davis all day long, the defensive lineman mm-hmm. for Georgia. So I'm not shocked to see Alabama and Bryce Young have that kind of success in the pass game against them. But it does, open up the question, like, is this defense as good as we thought it was? And, in a rematch, like, potentially if they can get by Michigan and Alabama gets by Cincinnati, are they going to fare any better?
Yeah, I think that's a very real thing. I think there are a couple of things at Georgia that you worry about now that you've seen Alabama have it. The SEC is a loaded conference. But when we look at the slate of teams that Georgia played, did they play a real prolific aerial attack? And they had most of the teams kind of played to Georgia's strength when it comes to the run game.
Right.
Secondly, their quarterback good enough? Stetson Bennett, is he good enough when the game falls on his shoulders to be able to do it? Because this is a team that has always kind of played from in front. They didn't necessarily need him to step outside of his comfort zone as a game manager to be a playmaker. So that would worry me. That said, the first round matchup, the semifinal matchup with, and we have time to talk about it, Georgia and Michigan, kind of plays to their strength, because the way Michigan wants to play, it's kind of like those SEC teams that want to come downhill and smash and do that. They can throw it some, but they're not their prolific pass attack that Alabama is. They're not prolific like Ohio State is when it comes to throwing the rock around the yard. So I worry about that. So then in a rematch against Alabama, if Alabama is able to get past Cincinnati, I do wonder what changes, because Bryce Young, I wouldn't say he played good, but I don't think he played great against Georgia. He had spectacular moments. And so now that he's seen the monster,
yeah,
he even played better if he gets another opportunity to face it.
Yeah. And look, it's interesting. We've got Aiden Hutchinson in this game who's, you know, could be a number one overall pick this year. You saw him in person, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I saw him in person. He is so good. He gets a sack where he does a double slap swim move, like in different directions to beat the tackle, then the running back to get a sack. And then he does some other stuff. And I think people need to understand, please don't miscast him as somebody who's just like a try-hard worker guy, because sometimes people associate guys that look like him like that.
Yes. No,
this
you're right.
This is a high-end, impressive athlete who is very skilled when it comes to his craft. And the comparison, the reason I compare him to Joey Bosa and those types is because I think Joey Bosa and Nick Bosa were two of the most skilled, refined players that we saw at the position come in, unlike some that are athletes that kind of went with their superior physical talent. These guys have a combination of great talent and great skills. And I think Aiden Hutchinson is that. And that's why we're hearing the buzz. Hey, he might be number one over Kayvon Thibodeau, who also recently announced that he is
just
coming
declared,
out
yeah.
this season. Yeah.
Yeah. And look, Thibodeau is a freak. I think we've seen that from time to time there at Oregon. I mean, like, I even think with Hutchinson, like, there's a little JJ Watt to his game with the physicality, but maybe even more athleticism to me coming off the edge than JJ had.
I would say that, because when you look at JJ, like, JJ's numbers when he tested coming out of Wisconsin were one thing. But I think, I don't know if we saw it look like that at Wisconsin.
Right.
When I look at Hutchinson, maybe it's the little small shoulder pads that he's playing with, the long arms. Like, he looks, man, that dude is athletic. He kind of looks like a swimmer. Like, he is so athletic and nimble.
It's fluid.
And and I think this is why he kind of ends up having the inside track to being the number one overall. Is what every coach wants is your best player to be your hardest worker.
Yeah.
And when you watch him, there is no doubt about his skill set, but there's also no doubt about his motor. I mean, he brings it each and every day, each and every play. And so, it's impressive to watch. Like, he's a very impressive prospect, like one of the best ones that I've seen. And I know, like, it took him a long time. It was a long road coming off that foot injury or whatever. But the production that he put up this year is outstanding. And when you go with the athleticism and the character and all that other stuff, it's going to be hard to move him out of that spot.
Yeah, I think you're right. And look, to me, like, maybe Thibodeau has a slightly higher ceiling in terms of overall talent and ability to become, you know, a perennial All-Pro, but it's not that different. And then for Hutchinson, the floor feels a fairly significant amount higher, like the safety of the
pick. It feels like you know exactly what you're getting. And man, like, digging into it, like, Rhett, like, just how as a 5-year-old, because his dad played at Michigan, and how he hung his dad's jersey up in his bedroom, and how he was like, I'm going to play and I'm going to do this stuff. And
broke his dad's record this year too.
Yeah.
Sack record at Michigan.
Just the drive and just all of those things, man, that is the stuff that you love when you're a scout. Like, man, guys who are all about it, like, football is the priority. It's about them taking care of business, the maturity that he's displayed. Yeah. And then, like, even in looking at his recent Instagram post where he puts the hashtag, those who will stay. Going back to the old Bo Schembechler thing, those who will stay will be champions. Like, all of the work that they put in is outstanding. And I'm going to say this, the defensive end or the edge rusher on the other side.
David Ojabo, not so bad, right? His name might be called a couple of spots right after Aiden Hutchinson. That's how good.
Yeah, holy smokes, man. Then I think about, like, man, they had all these dudes and Quiddy Pay and all the guys. You go back and you just think about the guys that have come out of there, like Uche and all this other stuff, like Rashawn Gary a little bit before them. They have done a great job of recruiting.
Gary was teammates with those two, with Ojabo and with Hutchinson when they were freshmen. Yeah.
Yeah. Recruiting and developing their guys. It's just now that we're off the Jim Harbaugh thing, because they beat Ohio State and they won the Big Ten. Now we can have a greater appreciation for what they've done, because, man, they look the part coming out. Because that's the one thing, like, you do when you're a scout, you look at pregame, and I'm watching them, and I'm also watching Iowa, who's also very impressive on the hoof when you catch a glimpse of them. Like, but It's a difference, though.
Well, and Tyler Linder, the problem for Iowa in that game is Tyler Linderbaum, he wasn't also playing left tackle and right tackle. He was only playing center.
He will challenge
draft records for centers in terms of highest center taken. Like, he's that good. I don't know where that record is right now, but Garrett Bradbury was taken, I think, in the top 20 out of NC State.
He was up there. Yeah.
Marquise or Mike Pouncey. I think Marquise or Mike might have been the highest by the Dolphins.
I think they're in the teens, but that
feels like a spot that Linderbaum could certainly go with the way that he's played. I think he's the odds on favorite to win the Remington this year as the nation's best center. So a lot of intrigue with the college football playoff as we get closer to the end of December. Can't wait to see those guys get out on the field. We'll certainly have an opportunity to continue to dig into those matchups. We were talking about edge rushers, though, and Hutchinson versus Thibodeau. Thibodeau now declaring his eligibility for the NFL draft, leaving Oregon, who also now has a void at head coach after the departure of Mario Cristobal to Miami. That on the docket next. Okay, it's been a absolutely wild coaching carousel in college football these last few weeks. More in-season firings and transition at leadership positions in marquee college programs than we've ever seen, and more money thrown around than we've ever seen. Hello, Lincoln Riley. Hello, Brian Kelly. Now, hello, Mario Cristobal, leaving Oregon after a successful run there as the Ducks head coach to go back to his roots in Miami. And this one kind of feels a little slimier in the way that it happened. I think it comes as no surprise to anyone, but it's almost like it was like, all right, Manny Diaz is still the head coach until we get Mario to sign it. Like, it all seemed a little bit backwards, you know, for an athletic department that's kind of without leadership there in Miami anyway, with no athletic director. So I guess I understand it. It's an unfortunate deal for Manny Diaz, who, like, okay, Mario decides to stay at Oregon, but do you really want me to stay now? You know, like, the whole thing felt like it was gonna be destined for transition in Miami.
Yeah, no, I mean, there definitely wasn't a model case for how to handle coaching transition. One, how to fire or remove a coach in a classy manner, and secondly, just the way that Mario Cristobal comes down. I certainly understand that Mario Cristobal being a Cane, having played there, having been an assistant there, having understood the inner workings of Hurricane culture. Like, I get it. But if you're going to make the move, make the move. You know what I'm saying? I think it's unfair to Manny Diaz, his family, his assistant coaches and their families to have to kind of deal with the yo-yo ride that did it. And it just kind of makes me wonder, when you step into that situation, like, look, it's all good when you come in, but are they then going to treat you like that on the way out? And so we're just kind of see how that plays out. But the move in general, I understand it from Cristobal's standpoint. Cristobal has built up Oregon into a national championship caliber contender, a team that certainly looks different than they even looked under Chip Kelly in terms of physicality, the size, the athletes, and what they were doing. When Chip was there, it was still more scheme-driven, not necessarily all talent-based and talent-driven. How they win now is a talent-driven deal. And so he gets credit for recruiting up in the Pacific Northwest. Now you give him kind of like that rich recruiting soil of, as they say down there, the state of Miami, where he doesn't have to get outside of Miami and just kind of throw a fence around the talent that is down there in South Florida. Yeah, you would like to think that he's able to take all the things that he learned along the way, including program building under Nick Saban, and put it in Miami. It's a scary thought. We'll see what it looks like, though.
Yeah, and look, this is a team that's got the reigning ACC Freshman of the Year coming back next year, and quarterback Tyler Van Dyke. It's also a team that had some big wins this year over number 18 NC State, over number 13 Pitt, and Heisman Trophy candidate Kenny Pickett. Of course, losing to Florida State hurts, certainly. But look, they won some games at the end of the season. Beat Virginia Tech, beat Duke, beat Georgia Tech, and put up some points doing it. So look, the cupboard's not bare. And then it's always a pretty, I don't know, I want to say quick, but the path to rebuilding that program to prominence starts in their own backyard, you know, which you can't necessarily say for every program in the country. But there you go. So now what do you think for Oregon? Is this a Chip Kelly reunion here, Bucky? I mean, it seems maybe a little far-fetched, but.
Yeah, this is a tough one because I feel like Chip finally has UCLA the way that he wants it, you know? But
bowl game 8-4, yep.
Bowl game 8-4, playing the way they want to play. I feel like he finally has his guys and he kind of has a formula and an understanding of how you have to win at UCLA with the academic restrictions and those things. Does he want to go back to Oregon? Because, like, sometimes, man, that second act when you go back isn't necessarily the same as the first go around. And the landscape of college football has changed so much that I don't know if he could live up to the legend that he is in Oregon when he returns. That said, man, that checkbook that Phil Knight has up there is big. And he certainly can lure him back if he wants to. I just wonder if Chip wants to take on that after kind of getting everything finally situated at UCLA. Does he want to kind of go back and kind of start all over a little bit when he goes to Oregon?
Sounds like, you know, there was some serious consideration for USC to bring Matt Campbell down from Iowa State to be their next head coach before Lincoln Riley ultimately got that job. Wonder if maybe that's a direction the Ducks would consider moving. It seems like the type of program that might interest Campbell.
I think so, because I don't think it's a high profile program per se, like in the city, like the USC thing. I think that would have been a tough one for Matt Campbell, because Matt Campbell would have been forced to do like probably more media obligations, like a bigger star. He probably would have to be out and about more in terms of being seen. When I look at the programs that he's been a part of, first Mountain Union, where he played, secondly at Toledo, then coming to Iowa State, those are kind of like small market. You're kind of the BMOC, but you can kind of hide under the radar. I feel like Oregon is a situation on a grander scale, but I still feel like the town of Eugene is still kind of small. He's not going to have to deal with what he would have to deal with. And I think you take the same model that he's used at Toledo, Iowa State, you drop it in at Oregon with more talented pieces. I mean, look, he can have a ton of success. At Iowa State, I think it's one of those things where every 3 or 4 years he'll build up a team to be able to vie for the Big 12. I don't know if it's sustainable to be a 10-win team at Iowa State.
Well, look at Kirk Ferentz has had, you know, has done in Iowa. I mean, gets his team to the Big Ten championship this year, and they're always in that 8-10 win range. But I don't. Are you going to win a national title there? I don't know. I mean, isn't that ultimately the goal?
Yeah, everything has to crack right when you're at those places. Right. And I think both of those guys, coaches, deserve a ton of credit. Ferentz, he's done at Iowa, and then what Matt Campbell has done at Iowa State in a relatively short time. Like, he has made them a national presence, not a national contender, but a national presence where, you know, Iowa State, you know what their brand is. He's done a really good job of that. But how do you reload and how do you rebuild and how do you sustain it and how long can you sustain it in a changing conference? Because the conference changes as well.
Okay, so much transition in the college football world among head coaches and offensive coordinators and defensive coordinators. And, you know, hopefully we get all these things filled here before we kick off next season. That's the kind of craziness we've seen so far. But that's going to do it for this episode of Move the Sticks. Back with another episode for you later this week. And, of course, DJ back here with Bucky and myself on Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern on NFL Network, wrapping up week 14 in the NFL. Coming down the stretch here, Bucky. Great to be with you here, man. And thanks to Nabil for getting us rolling here on a Move the Sticks. And we'll catch you next time right here on Move the Sticks.